You look at Owen again, but I'm totally aware of him. As he watches me submit to Steve's desires without question, I see myself through his eyes and realize that, deep down, this is what I want. The idea of one man making love to me in front of another man turns me on so much, I wake up. Chapter 8. The Sistrum sailed past Tel El Amarna, the desolate place where, for some inexplicable reason, the heretic pharaoh Akhenaten chose to build his new capital. After his death, when Egypt promptly returned to the old religion, the city was torn down and every trace of Akhenaten and his ideas destroyed. Consequently, there is nothing left to see now except painfully empty desert. I wasn't sorry to leave Tel El Amarna behind. I was glad to just stay on the boat and relax. The sun was at its zenith and beating down on both sides of the deck when I spread myself out on one of the lounge chairs. Steve was spending time with the captain, a tall, handsome man who looked like he could have navigated these waters thousands of years ago. Just looking at him, it was obvious that somewhere in his genetic code, ancient Egyptian genes still lingered. No cool breeze caressed me, and it wasn't very peaceful on the Sistrum's gleaming deck. The hot orange light behind my closed eyelids was alive with the steady drone of the engine and the occasional high-pitched buzz of a mosquito. I might have been listening to a cosmic generator, a reminder that the sun is not immortal, but will burn out in the end and take the entire solar system with it, like an ancient Babylonian king buried with his nearest and dearest subjects. I couldn't stop thinking about my dream. It felt so real. I had been sure I was awake, but I should have known I was dreaming. The few times I'd been able to get Carol to lend me her phone, I had been reading up on lucid dreaming. Last night, I should have done what was called a reality check, which would have told me right away that I was dreaming, because in reality, Steve would never behave in such a fashion. Maybe I hadn't become lucid because then I might have remembered to do a reality check, and I really hadn't wanted to. If I had discovered I was dreaming, I would have been obliged to take responsibility for my actions. Yet that was circular reasoning, since I had believed I was awake, and I still behaved as I had, which was even worse. At least if I had known I was dreaming, I wouldn't have needed to feel guilty about having some fun. But I was pretty sure that wasn't sound reasoning either. The truth was, I wanted to feel like I had in that dream, so sexy, so desirable, so aroused it was almost painful. Was I really like that, deep down? When I thought about such a scenario happening as part of the actual flow of time, with a past and a future, and not just in some hot, suspended, sexy present, I knew I would not be into it at all. There might not be consequences in dreams and daydreams, but in reality, there were, and if Steve behaved as he had in my sleeping imagination, he would not be Steve. He would not be the person I had fallen in love with and longed to be with. He was virile and in command, but in a spiritual sense. His personality, his soul possessed those qualities. He knew what he believed, he did not waver, and he was in command of himself, of his thoughts and his actions. What he wasn't was cold and selfish and abusive, like he had been in my dream. He had taken command of me in my dream in a sexual way, and in waking life, he was taking command of our future together by not sleeping with me right away. Reaching this point in my thoughts soothed my restless tension somewhat, and I began drifting off, until the sound of approaching footsteps made me open my eyes. Owen was walking toward me, his own eyes fixed on the shapely pyramid of my one bent leg.
"Hello," he said.
"Hello," I echoed.
"Where's your boyfriend?"
"Hanging out with the captain."
"Mind if I join you?"
"Go ahead." I told myself I was simply being polite. Perching on the edge of the chair beside mine, he reached for his heart and pulled out a pack of cigarettes.
"Do you mind?"
he asked belatedly. "No," I lied. Leaning back, he pulled a book of matches out of a front pocket of his black pants and in the still heat easily lit the cigarette. He blew an impressive column of smoke toward the river, then looking down, took another quick drag, exhaling a stream of smoke between his legs before he met my eyes and said,
"Tell me, Mary, did you enjoy your dream last night?"
Seriously tempted to do a reality check, I whispered, "Who are you?" Glancing up at the sky, he took a hard drag. Then, rising abruptly, he tossed the cigarette overboard.
"Can't you guess?"
He walked away, but the smell of smoke and a faint whiff of sulfur lingered in his wake. A moment later, I discovered the reason for his abrupt exit when Steve appeared, and standing over me, stared at Owen's retreating figure for a few seconds before informing me,
"He works for Richard. He's one of his location and talent scouts."
"You've got to be kidding me."
"I wish I was."
I'm standing at the ship's railing. Everything is pitch black except for one sunlit area far to the northwest. But then the scene winks out and I'm plunged into absolute darkness. Yet it isn't frightening, and as I keep staring straight ahead of me, that scene to the northwest reappears in stunning depth and clarity. I can just make out a castle-like mansion with a reddish-brown pyramid-style roof which dominates the bright green landscape. Suddenly, I feel a leg pressing against the side of my left leg, followed by the sensation of a hand resting on and then gently grasping the top of my left thigh. I wonder if I should be frightened, but I quickly decide that it's okay, because this is just a dream. A measureless amount of time passes before a man steps out of the darkness. He possesses a very real presence, an aura of command that feels independent of my imagination. He's tall and solidly built, and he looks familiar, a little like Owen, except his hair is short. His pants are black, but his short-sleeved shirt is a misty gray. I find myself leaning back against the railing facing him. Without speaking, he lets me know he's not pleased that I'm still fully clothed and that he wants to see more flesh, which makes sense because I've already decided that all I want from him is sex. That's what we're both here in this dream for. Faster than the blink of an eye, I'm naked. And his touch on the right side of my pelvis ignites desire in me. I distinctly experience the hot sensation, and I can hardly wait for him to penetrate me. Suddenly, I'm hovering above the river, watching myself leaning over the railing. I imagine I can feel the pleasure of being penetrated, but there isn't enough realistic pressure or friction, not enough motion, just a glowing ecstasy, like the kind I can give myself. Wanting more, I begin moving my hips aggressively back and forth, and abruptly I'm on the deck again facing my partner. His shirt is gone, and I distinctly feel his bare, hairless chest, on which I glimpse a dark mark. Beneath a faint smile, his expression is serious and inscrutable, pleased yet detached, as though he's some sort of dream world gigolo. Yet we're also involved in a deeper sense beyond this superficial erotic pleasure. I begin waking up. After breakfast, I found myself avoiding Steve's eyes. When he asked me if I was feeling okay, I lied and said I hadn't slept well. There was some truth to that, because this morning I felt I had not dreamed well. I had used becoming lucid to have sex with another man, a complete stranger. Of course, if I'd really had sex, I would have felt pain and discomfort because I was a virgin. Still, the experience had been realistic in every other sense, and the guilt I was suffering from now was certainly real. I had been offered a chance to have consequences-free sex, and I'd gone for it. I hadn't even thought of Steve. I remembered what Carol had said about him. "He's too good for me," as I now felt the same way. But as usually happens after food and coffee, my mood lifted, and I was able to convince myself that a dream was just a dream, and unless I told him about it, there was no way for Steve to find out how I'd behaved last night
while I was in bed alone, or almost. And, I told myself, I wouldn't do it again. The experience had been tantalizing, but ultimately not very satisfying. Yet I kept seeing the knowing look on that perfectly handsome man's face. In the dream, I knew he knew I had conjured him from the darkness to have sex. It had been my decision to let him enter my lucid space as nothing more than a sex object, an anonymous figure I could use in my dream to experience a pleasure I had not yet fully enjoyed in waking life. This man had seemed fully aware of the fact that I was using him to get off. He had been hiding in the darkness waiting for me, and I did not doubt I had behaved as he had hoped and expected I would. I had felt nothing for him as a person. I had behaved in a way completely contrary to my true nature, which, just like Carol's, was to fall in love with every guy I dated. I knew lots of girls who could have sex like they ate lunch, but I could never be one of them. The man from my dream had felt very real to my touch, but he had not been warm in any sense. Fortunately, we were on a cruise and there was a schedule to keep, and I could forget about my dream as I looked forward to the Temple of Horus, which was comfortably close to the river on the west bank. I suppose it was impressive, but it wasn't long before I was sick of stylized statues of falcons. Everywhere I looked, there was a huge stone bird frowning at me sternly with its downturned beak and empty bulbous stone eyes. Ptolemaic art didn't do a thing for me. Not even Steve's remarks lightened my crushing boredom. He kept pointing out hieroglyphs devoted to preserving information about the metaphysical nature of this and all other Egyptian temples as symbolizing the island of creation, or the first occasion, when heaven and earth came into existence. My interest resurrected somewhat when my super smart boyfriend pointed out scenes and inscriptions relating to the sacred drama, the age-old conflict between Horus and Set. This conflict no longer felt like an abstract concept. I had been on the front lines all day thinking about my lucid dream and how eagerly I had given in to temptation. I tried, but failed to succeed in convincing myself that it didn't matter because it was only a dream, for I had been fully conscious of my actions. If it had been just that one dream I was keeping a secret, it might not have been so bad, but this was the third dream I hadn't told Steve about. My reticence had begun with the dream I had entitled The Toys of God, and then there was the dream with him and Owen, and now this last one with a man who had looked uncomfortably like Richard's location and talent scout. Naturally, he was linked to Richard in some way, but it was impossible. I could not be so vain as to believe Owen's presence was anything more than coincidence. It simply couldn't be true. Richard was still interested in me and not giving up on me, as he had promised he wouldn't. Steve and I shunned the guided tour, but we couldn't avoid the group completely, and as we passed one of the 9 shrines, we heard the guide tell everyone, "Many of the temple's carved reliefs were destroyed by followers of the Christian faith which came to dominate Egypt." The statement rang in my head and lingered there, resonating with emotions I didn't want to acknowledge, but which now reared before me like the carvings of cobras crowned by solar disks. Falling in love with Steve was destroying my carefree pagan attitude towards sex. Sure, I was still a virgin, but more than once, I'd come close to losing that status, and it had certainly never been my intention to wait until I was married to have sex with my husband. Now I even felt guilty about having sex in a dream. Through Steve, the Christian faith was coming to dominate me. Excusing myself, I trekked back to the visitor center to use the ladies' room. I washed my hands, then also splashed water over my face, which was hot and flushed. The water felt wonderful to my skin, divinely cool and refreshing. Maybe I was just suffering from temple fatigue. Yet I knew the real reason I didn't feel right. Staring at my reflection in the mirror, I faced the root of my growing distress, and all the temptations that had been sprouting inside me as a result, and which my dreaming mind suddenly seemed obsessed with cultivating. I was keeping secrets from Steve. Whereas before I had eagerly described every dream I had to him, I was now keeping them from him. And since these dreams revealed my inner life, I was keeping parts of myself from him. I was detaching myself from him. I was failing to share myself openly and honestly with him. I was beginning to treat his faith like a problem. And yet only a few days ago in Cairo, I had felt exactly the opposite. I hurried back to the temple, but I couldn't see Steve anywhere. So I waited just outside it, at a white railing, blocking the entrance to a dark shrine not open to the public, standing in the shadow of the square stone opening. I leaned over the railing, trying to make out the reliefs on the wall closest to me. No sound accompanied the sudden sensation of a leg pressing against mine, then of a large hand coming to rest lightly on the top of my left thigh as a hot breath filled my ears and a male voice whispered, "Did you enjoy yourself?" I stepped away from him. It was Owen standing there, but his expression was very different from the neutral look he had worn in my dream. His eyes and smile flashed triumphantly. "What are you talking about?" I demanded, a knee-jerk reaction as his question hit a supernatural nerve and kicked the normal reality I had been living and playing in completely off the map. I knew perfectly well what he was talking about. It just wasn't possible. Was this how people had felt when evidence the Earth wasn't flat began sailing into ports?
"Richard sends his greetings, Mary."
I literally ran away from him and back into the temple. Desperate to find Steve, I ended up at the entrance to the 9 sanctuaries, which were deserted now, haunting man-made caves into which curious waves of humanity flowed in and out again, day in and day out. The light on the wall across from the last sanctuary dimmed and brightened, flickering with a dangerous-sounding electric crackle. Abruptly, I suffered the impression this corridor lined with gods was a virtual reality set fraying at the edges, with real space, a magical fourth dimension, just beyond it. I was alone with Anubis, depicted on the wall beside me in his form of a man with the head of a black jackal, who suddenly grabbed me roughly from behind, pulled me into one of the shrines, and began kissing me fiercely. Seconds later, Steve's voice reverberated like thunder through the small stone space.
"What the hell?"
Talon-like fingers stopped digging painfully into my arms, and I was able to catch my breath as Owen said disdainfully,
"Look at her. She's just standing there waiting for more. She's not upset. She's excited. She wants both of us."
Steve thrust his body between me and the other man's.
"Stay away from her."
I held on to the back of Steve's shirt as Owen stepped out of the shrine. The flickering light behind him made his hair appear to be burning around his face as he said coldly,
"I can't promise I'll do that, Stefano."
He disappeared into the darkness. I shivered violently.
"It's all right."
Steve enfolded me in his arms and held me close as I trembled.
"He can't hurt you. I won't let him. I promise."
I clung to him. I wanted to tell him I hadn't let Owen kiss me, but he seemed to know that already, thank God.
"Come on, sweetheart."
He shifted our position so we could begin walking while still keeping an arm around each other.
"Let's get out of here and back into the sun."
We made it to the bus before everyone else. Steve led me to the very back and made me take the window seat. "Steve?"
"Shh, don't say anything, Mary. And don't wander off like that again, please."
"But I can't believe he did that. He just grabbed me."
"Don't think about it. Everything's okay now. But when we get back to Cairo, I'd really like you to come to church with me."
This sudden request shocked me almost as much as being abruptly taken hold of and violently kissed against my will. Even though it was warm on the motionless bus, I shivered again violently as though some major upheaval was happening in the core of my body I had no control over. Steve spoke slowly and very gently.
"Mary, promise me you'll come to church with me."
"Of course I will." I felt him relax against me, which mysteriously made me feel better. I still didn't understand why he had brought that up now. But then I remembered how strangely shocked I had been when Owen called Steve Stefano,
his baptismal name.
"Steve, how did Owen know your real name? I mean, the name you were baptized with? Did you talk to him on the ship when I wasn't around?"
"No."
"So it was a lucky guess?"
"I think not," he said, and crossed himself.
Chapter 9. As dinner was being served in the dining room, the sistrum came to a full stop in the middle of the Nile. The sun had only just set and the gas lamps had not yet been lit, but the tall figure of our captain, standing at the railing, was precisely silhouetted against the pale violet sky. Rolling our carry-ons behind us, Steve and I walked toward him. I was discovering that attempting to turn off my thoughts sharpened my physical senses to the point where they bled into my emotions, which had the effect of making my anxiety feel indistinguishable from the subtle but all-pervasive scent of the river. When we reached him, the captain silently opened a small gate in the railing, and I was just able to make out a little boat bobbing gently on the water below us. A man in dark robes held up his arms, and one by one Steve tossed him our luggage, including my purse. Then he said softly,
"Go on,"
as the man reached up for me. Leaning forward and stretching my arms down toward him, I let him lift me down into the boat. Immediately he let go of me as Steve jumped lightly on board and prevented me from losing my balance by grabbing one of my hands and pulling me down onto the hard seat beside him. The boat's motor purred smoothly to life, and we began gliding swiftly toward the east bank. I resisted the temptation to look back at the ship, where I wouldn't have been surprised to see Owen standing at the railing observing our not-so-secret departure. I was sure it would amuse him to watch us running away from him like two scared kids. When we reached the shore, the silent Egyptian quickly deposited our suitcases on the wooden dock as Steve helped me up. Yards ahead of us was a small scattering of lights that simply deepened the darkness. When I heard a crunching sound and a car abruptly caught us in its headlights, I stumbled on the uneven ground. Steve had obviously been expecting it because he walked straight into the light and opened one of the back doors for me. He helped load our bags into the trunk, then slipped in close beside me. He said not a word to the driver, who already seemed to know where we wanted to go, because the instant Steve closed the door behind him, he turned the wheel sharply to the right and floored the accelerator. Approximately 1 hour later, we arrived at Luxor International Airport. I didn't want to think about how much this cab ride had cost Steve, but at least he was letting me pay for our flights back to Cairo. Thanks to him and Simon, I had spent a fraction of my allotted budget for this trip to Egypt, a land which seemed to be located on a mysterious and potentially dangerous border between dimensions. We hadn't talked much during the long, dark drive. We had already done that back in his cabin when I had finally told him about my Toys of God dream, and then, avoiding his eyes, about the two other naughty dreams I'd had while on board the Sistrum. He had listened in that mysteriously reassuring way of his, deeply and intently, and I was surprised when, finally daring to look at him, I saw that he was smiling at me. In an almost matter-of-fact way, he had said,
"Thank you for telling me, Mary."
Then, pulling me to my feet, commanded,
"Go pack your things. We're getting off this ship."
We might not have made it to the airport in time if the 7:30 flight to Cairo hadn't been delayed over an hour. Steve had already booked our tickets online. Even at such short notice, there had been a handful of seats remaining, a sign of the record lows to which tourism had plummeted in a country where it was crucial to the economy. Maybe because Steve spoke Arabic and had a work visa, we sailed through chaotic checkpoints, where subtly but firmly he made it clear to the officials that I was under his protection. Upstairs in departures there was nowhere to sit except in one of the lounge restaurants, but since we were both starving, that was okay. And this time, I wasn't surprised when I was met inside the bathroom by a young boy selling toilet paper. Since I hadn't brought my own and definitely needed some, I was more than happy to give him some backsheesh for it. Takeoff was breathtaking. I got to see the Temple of Hatshepsut all lit up, looking as it might have during the beautiful festival of the valley, when entire families crossed the river to spend time with deceased loved ones in the offering chapels of their tombs. Carol had of course shown me the dozens of photos she had taken during her nocturnal hot air balloon ride over Luxor, but the actual experience, although brief, was more affecting, as for a few transcendent moments my body shared the same space with the splendorous view. I said to Steve, "There's a dreamlike quality to flying at night when you're wide awake."
"It's a little like being in void space," he agreed.
"Void space. I think I experienced that in my Toys of God dream when everything went black, but I kept my hands planted on what felt like a wall until the scene reappeared around me." His head still resting on the back of his seat, he turned it toward me just as a mechanical bell rang and the red fasten seat belt sign went off. But I kept mine on because the look in Steve's eyes made me feel I needed it now more than ever. His voice pitched so only I could hear it. He said,
"Mary, I'll never give you orders or commands, and I'll never even pretend to hurt you."
He turned his head away again. It was a warning as well as a promise. I knew that. He was telling me that if kinky sex was something I thought I wanted, he wasn't the guy for me, and I wasn't the girl for him. Not in the least bit afraid to open my heart to him, I replied, "I want love, true love. But I like it when you're firm with me, and how in command you are of yourself and what you believe. But that doesn't hurt me. On the contrary, your firmness is, I don't know, it feels like a mysterious form of tenderness that inspires me to open up to you. And talking to you is more exciting than anything." His eyes closed. I couldn't believe it. I was laying my soul at his feet, and he was falling asleep. His eyes opened again, but he didn't look at me as he said,
"I'm very happy to hear that, Mary, because I love you."
The drone of the engine suddenly became almost deafening. Had I heard him right? He had spoken so quietly. Maybe I had only imagined he had just told me he loved me. Maybe he had said, "Trust, not love. Because I trust you." Yeah, that made sense. But what if he really had said, "I love you"? I couldn't just sit here. I had to respond. Grabbing his hand, feeling as if the plane was literally plummeting toward the ground and I had only seconds to save my life, I whispered passionately in his ear, "I love you too." I prayed I hadn't misunderstood him and gone too far too fast, and that these weren't my final seconds of happiness. Raising both our hands along with the armrest between us, Steve turned, and pressing me back against my seat with his free hand, he kissed me, but not on the cheek, and not briefly. The remainder of the flight, the arrival in Cairo, and the taxi ride back to Carol's place all happened in a dream I failed to wake up from, even after I reluctantly closed the apartment door behind me. I was glad Steve hadn't listened to me earlier when I tried to insist there was no need for him to accompany me all the way home. Our prolonged farewell now, on a landing beside a door just like our first kiss, had made it clear he knew better. The molecules in the air silently told me Carol was out, but I suspected she'd be home later because she disliked Simon's messy apartment, narrow bed, and especially his bathroom. I was glad she wasn't home. It would have been too much of an effort to talk right now. I was simultaneously too elated and too drained from the intensity of the past few days, yet I barely felt the weight of my carry-on roll purring behind me. By now, I knew the guest room by heart, and in a matter of moments, all the lamps were lit and I was standing in front of the table on which rested my lovely Bible. Tomorrow I would begin reading where I had left off at the beginning of Matthew, the first of the four Gospels. But just then I couldn't resist caressing the smooth, skin-like leather before gently, reverently, opening the book up to somewhere in the New Testament, hoping to see letters printed in red, which meant Jesus was speaking. I struck gold. There were paragraphs in red on both pages, but my eyes landed on these lines first. Keep watch and pray, so that you will not give in to temptation. For the spirit is willing, but the body is weak. Mark 14:38. At breakfast, I told Carol that Steve and I had had a great time on our cruise, which was true. I left out all the other stuff that would have required diving into depths we didn't have the time to explore this morning because we were going shopping again. On the top of the list today was furniture. Simon had given her a small but huge present, a copy of his American Express card. But since the bundle of cash her fiancé had also supplied her with didn't fit in her slim little pocket wallet, she was forced to carry a purse over one shoulder and her camera over the other, which seriously annoyed her. Carol never went anywhere without her camera. Well, I said, at least you don't have a baby to carry yet. She gave me a dirty look I felt I deserved, sort of. I was probably feeling just a little bit jealous. She had even jumped the hurdle of talking to her parents, although only the first and easiest one. They now knew she was engaged, but not that she was pregnant. My tourist visa was going to expire soon, and before it did, I still had to call my own parents. But not now. Physically, I was fine, but on all other levels, I felt drained. Like a turtle retreating into its shell, my brain just wanted to hide from all the intense, incredible, and even impossible experiences I'd had since my plane touched down in Egypt. It was the perfect day to shop and daydream and make suggestions to Carol about how to decorate her guest room. Armed with her smartphone, Carol directed Hamu to the first store on her list, Caravanserai, which sold authentic handmade furniture from Africa and Turkey. I imagined the quaintly traditional colonial style would appeal more to British expats, and Carol soon strode out of there, directing Hamoud to In and Out, which we didn't walk out of for well over an hour. While Carol strode around the showroom, I relaxed on a long, cushy couch with a divan on one end. I loved the slate-blue color of the fabric, which for me evoked a bed of lotus flowers growing out of the soft sand-colored carpet, the corners of which were carved bas-relief style with wavy designs evocative of desert mountains. When Carol returned, I urged her to sit down beside me on the divinely comfortable couch as I did my best to sell her on it. I'll think about it. She got up. Let's go. I sighed, already a little bored. I was also hungry, and I missed Steve, and I wanted to get back to the apartment for some reason. No one was there, except maybe Liba, but just thinking about the guest room, which was my room for now, I felt impatient to return to it. Why was that? I wasn't tired, so it wasn't like I was missing the comfy bed in the room because I wanted to take a nap. While Carol and I were lost in Markaz in Mahdi, Hamoud had plenty of time for tea at a nearby Awas and a game of backgammon while smoking apple-flavored tobacco from a shisha water pipe. The store's two floors were filled from floor to ceiling with crafts from all over Egypt. Carpets, handmade bed covers and throws, tablecloths, and striped pillows of all sizes, although I preferred the pillows embroidered with colorful landscapes. However, all I bought were a few handmade notebooks to use as future dream journals. Scattered all over the shop were brightly painted baskets of all shapes and sizes. In addition to numerous other items, Carol bought five of the baskets for art supplies, future baby's toys, and whatever. Back in the car, hot as an oven and smelling of freshly baked apple pie, I quickly said, "Home, please, Hamoud," before Carol could direct him to yet another store. When she didn't protest, I relaxed against the back seat, happy we were on our way back to the apartment. I was hungry, but, I admitted to myself, not just for food, at least not the kind of food you put into your mouth. I wanted to get back to my room so I could read my Bible passage for the day. I hadn't had time this morning. Back home, I dropped my bags and purse on the couch and made it to the bathroom before Carol. After quickly relieving myself and washing and then thoroughly drying my hands, because the paper in the holy book is very fine, I hurried into my bedroom and closed the door behind me. I felt excited and a little nervous. The space no longer felt empty, and not just because I was there now. An eager reverence in my steps, I walked over to the thick book lying on the table in front of the window, the blinds of which were open, letting in the light. The fingers of my left hand resting on the cover, I reached for the silky white tassel of the cloth bookmark, but then stopped, my hand suspended in midair as though waiting for an invisible presence to grasp it, as I saw a flower lying on the table just to the right of the Bible, a pale pink lily with a white heart and tall golden stamens. A surprise inseparable from joy filled me, because before my brain could think to wonder how it had gotten there, my soul recognized and received it as a gift. Even as my mind kicked into gear, the wave of awe that had broken silently through me did not ebb, but kept my heart floating on its unfathomable depths. Had Steve been here? He had his own key to the apartment now, so it was entirely possible he had come over, and not finding anyone home, had left me this little present. To remind me to read my Bible? No, that didn't feel right. He was not pushy like that. Besides, he had made it clear he would be busy with Simon all day and evening. Simon also had a key, but he would never leave me a flower.
Liba.
Liba! She was in my room every day. I had never seen her carrying flowers, just mops and dusters, the broom, the vacuum, dust cloths and bottles of cleaners, buckets and towels, but no flowers. Yet Liba was the only viable suspect, as my parents would say. The evidence all pointed squarely at her. Yes, it did indeed seem that Hamoud's youngest daughter was guilty of this lovely gesture, this sweet and meaningful gift. Gently, I picked up the lily, intending to go ask Carol if she had a small vase I could put it in, but then I lay it down again. First, I would read my passage for the day. I opened the Bible to my bookmark. I knew exactly where I had left off, because the title for this section was The Escape to Egypt. So I read Matthew 2:13-23, which began with the departure of the wise men, who had been warned in a dream not to return to King Herod after they had seen the baby Jesus. The rest of the passage was about Joseph taking his family to Egypt and then returning after Herod's death. I knew the story, my grandparents had told it to me, but I was struck now by a fact I had never noticed. In this reading, messages received in a dream were crucial, as was how the dreamer reacted, by obeying the warning. It stunned me to think that Christianity existed because of a series of dreams. If the wise men had returned to Herod and told him Jesus was the great king the star had led them to, that would have been very bad. And just as fatal would have been Joseph disobeying the angel who told him in a dream to flee to Egypt, and then, 7 years later, told him in another dream to go home. I knew from earlier readings that the first angel Joseph had seen in a dream had told him not to be afraid to take Mary as his wife, because the child within her had been conceived by the Holy Spirit. That made four dreams I had read in only 3 pages of Matthew's Gospel. These four dreams were the cornerstones of Christianity, dreams sent from God and delivered by angels. I was stunned and thrilled, but not surprised, for my own journey to Christ had begun in a dream. I looked at my dream journal, just lying there in the open. No. I was sure Liba would respect my privacy, and I certainly wasn't going to hide my dreams now in some rude, distrustful response to her gracious gesture of leaving me a flower. Maybe she wanted to be friends? I wasn't sure how that would work, but I was willing to try. Chapter 10. I'm in a dark bedroom watching a horror movie.
A big budget production with really sexy male and female characters. Getting up off the bed, I go and stand in front of a full-length mirror and watch as my reflection swiftly transforms into the seductive image of the film's heroine, the beloved of the evil protagonist who wants her back. I'm lucidly conscious that I shouldn't be letting this happen, but part of me can't resist watching myself grow taller and even more irresistibly beautiful, with long straight black hair flowing down to my waist, merging with a long, tight black evening dress. But as I wrap a matching black cloak around myself, I catch sight of my glowing yellow evil eyes, and quickly turning away from the mirror, I feel someone diffusing the black magic I had dipped my dreaming awareness into. I realize I should have turned away from the mirror immediately instead of falling under its spell. Leaving the bedroom, I walk into the dark den of my parents' house back in Boston, which is empty of all furnishings. Something feels really off. Abruptly, I'm looking down at the den from where I'm sitting in midair, my back against the wall, my bare legs stretched out in front of me. I seem to have floated up here against gravity, and now I'm looking straight down at the glass doors leading outside, which are lit as if by moonlight. I understand, then, that I'm out of body in the middle of the night, but I'm not afraid. I feel ready to hold my ground. Our dead black cat, Whispers, is sitting outside, directly in front of the glass door and beneath the latch that opens it. It's clearly Whispers, our dear dead kitty. I say, "Come in, Wispies," and she immediately passes straight through the glass. I point my right index finger at her, and she sits down in the middle of the room, looking up at me. Feeling her obedience to my silent commands, I allow myself to slide down the wall to the floor. As I do so, I keep my eyes on our cat, who begins morphing and growing, taking the form of a dog, a big, black, friendly-looking Labrador. "Yes, that's right," I say, feeling safe now and ready for whatever is about to happen. I turn toward the interior entrance to the room and step closer to it as a figure appears, moving toward me from the dark corridor beyond, but stopping when it reaches the threshold. It's a man, no bigger than a child, but he's not a dwarf because his proportions appear to be normal. He's dressed in a strange black and white outfit, a tunic that swells out around his squat torso in an oval, almost circular shape, above black leggings or boots. But I don't really see his legs or his feet, and there's a big puffy white hat on his head. I can't say for certain, but there seems to be a meaning to the black patterns on the white cloth of his tunic, like a symbolic language or magical symbols flowing into each other. It's too dark for me to see his face clearly, but I can tell it's unremarkable, ageless-looking, and almost expressionless. We simply stand facing each other for a moment before I ask, "Who are you?" And he replies, "Johnny Askaround." Almost laughing out loud, I repeat, "Johnny Askaround," and then just stare at him. I don't trust him. I can't put my finger on my distrust, apart from the fact that I was expecting trouble, but there's something sinister about the way he's just standing there, as if he can't come any closer, as if he can't cross the threshold, and is forced to wait for me to invite him into the space in which I'm standing. I don't need to think about it. I simply obey my intuition and ask him, "Are you of God?" In a calm, reasonable tone, he begins replying, "That's a relative." But I interrupt him firmly. "No, I mean the God of the Bible, Jesus Christ." As I speak the Lord's name, he takes a small but visible step back. Raising my voice slightly, I move toward him, confronting him with the statement, "If you're not a follower of Christ, you are not welcome in my dreams." He's obviously backing away from me now, hurrying into a dark space to my right, where he stops in front of what resembles a very dark bar. Suddenly, a tall young woman steps between me and the strange little man, and together she and I move back into the den. Through the dark wall, I can still see Johnny Askaround standing there. I really want to remember this dream, so I quickly go through what's happened so far in my mind
before giving my full attention to the woman. When she begins walking, I fall into step with her. The den has transformed into a narrow corridor lined with closed doors, and I get the distinct impression it's located very high up in the atmosphere, even beyond it, somewhere between outer space and the planet, or in traditional terms, heaven and earth. The woman is in her prime, very attractive, and much taller than I am. As I study her smooth, pale, very strong-looking bare arms, I ask, "Who are you?" A strange little smile on her mouth. She doesn't look at me as she replies, "I'm something." I keep pace with her, even as I suffer a sinking sensation, because I seem to know what she means. "You're not a created soul?" I almost feel sorry for her as she ignores my question to tell me about the enemy. She says, "He's trying to make it so no one can escape, regardless of the fact that this could destroy everything." I'm pretty sure I know what she means as I ask, "Where is this place? Is it somewhere beyond the physical?" But she interrupts me, "You don't understand. He has plans." Her warning still in my ears, I slip out of the dream and wake up. In the morning, I slipped as silently as I could into Carol's room, unplugged her phone, and closing the door carefully behind me, took it back to my room, where I sat down cross-legged on the bed and Googled, "Do angels have souls?" One of the first sites that came up was gotquestions.org, a site where biblical questions are answered and where I read, "Angels were created as an order of creatures higher than humans. Therefore, they innately possess greater knowledge. Unlike humans, angels do not have to study the past. They have experienced it. Therefore, they know how others have acted and reacted in situations and can predict with a greater degree of accuracy how we may act in similar circumstances. Though they have wills, angels, like all creatures, are subject to the will of God. Good angels are sent by God to help believers. Angels are an entirely different order of being than humans. Human beings do not become angels after they die. Angels will never become and never were human beings. Angels are spiritual beings that can, to a certain degree, take on physical form." As I sat there absorbing this information, I found myself remembering the tall man at the pyramids with the look of a soldier who had stepped between me and Richard's assistant as he was trying to pull me over to his employer. And then, suddenly, I was recalling Richard's hotel room and the moment when a tall man in brilliant white robes kicked open the door and began yelling at my captor in a language that didn't sound like Arabic. I pulled up an audio file of a man speaking Aramaic, one of the languages spoken by Christ, who, judging by his ability to communicate with Romans and other Gentiles, had also spoken Latin, possibly Greek, and, of course, Hebrew. Jesus hadn't been some sort of skinny hippie. He had been very well educated and a working carpenter, which meant he would have developed some upper body strength at least. Although I couldn't be sure, it was possible the man who nearly broke Richard's door down had been speaking Aramaic, an ancient Syrian language still in use in some areas, but which had otherwise nearly died out. I tossed the phone onto the bed, suddenly worried I was going just a little bit or a lot crazy. Was I seriously entertaining the notion that those two men, who had literally stepped in to keep me away from Richard, had been angels briefly taking physical form to help me in a crucial moment? And what exactly did that make Richard? The devil himself? Then I remembered what Steve had said, a comment I had filed into the back of my mind to remember later. "When the Holy Spirit begins drawing a soul closer to God, the enemy notices and goes on the attack using people who serve him, either deliberately or by thinking only of their own selfish pleasures." Yep, I had no problem believing Richard was an agent of the devil. He had told me his religion was himself. And of course, he'd been lying when he said he wasn't sleeping with that actress who had been lying beside him by the pool of the Mina House Hotel, motionless as one of Dracula's brides. Richard did seem to have been telling the truth when he said he wouldn't give up on me so easily, but I still couldn't quite believe he had deliberately sent Owen after me. What purpose would that serve if he wanted me for himself? But, of course, I knew there were men like that, who desired a woman and power over her, but who didn't mind sharing her body with other men. On the contrary, it turned them on. I ran back down the corridor into Carol's room, and this time made as much noise as possible as I plugged her phone back in, where she kept it on her nightstand. But Carol didn't stir. I sighed, because I really didn't want to be alone with my thoughts right now, which were really out there, outer space out there, like the place I'd found myself in at the end of my lucid dream, which had felt like a space station orbiting the Earth. But I resisted the selfish temptation to wake my friend up. Instead, I took a long, hot shower, anticipating the simple pleasure of breakfast and the fact that, in a few hours, I would be seeing Steve again. Yet even this happy anticipation was tainted by a slight anxiety, because today, for the first time in well over a decade, I was going to enter a church, not when it was shadowy and empty so Carol could take photographs, but when it was illuminated and full of people there to attend an actual living mass. Struggling for breath where he sat on the couch, Steve gasped, "I'm sorry." "Stop it!" I was trying hard not to laugh myself where I stood over him. "But that's really what he said when I asked him what his name was. Johnny Askaround." He began laughing again. Reaching for me like a drowning man, he pulled me down onto the couch with him, and I gladly helped save his life by letting him share my breath through a long, deep kiss as we clung to each other. When he had sobered up, he said,
"Johnny Askaround, the dangers of hearsay, of just asking around about important subjects instead of really educating yourself. The enemy loves online gossip and billboard platitudes. The truth is always richer, but also more demanding. Brilliant dream, Mary, but we'll talk about it later. We have to get going now."
Pulling me to my feet, he smoothed my slightly crumpled white dress around my waist and hips, taking his time. Turning me around, he did the same thing. Then, resting one hand on the small of my back, with his other hand, he caressed my hair over one shoulder so he could kiss the nape of my neck. A delicious prison of pleasure coursed through my body between his lips and his hand. The sensation was subtly electric, as if my spine was akin to a divine lightning rod. Inside me, all my nerve ends seemed to tremble like flowers blooming beneath the warm breeze of his breath. I didn't want him to stop. But why was he doing this now, when we were about to leave for church? Was this some sort of Catholic foreplay I'd never heard of? If so, I was ready to get confirmed this afternoon. Turning me to face him again, he said,
"You look beautiful. Are you ready?"
If attending Mass was part of achieving a deeper intimacy with him, then hell yeah, I was ready. "I need you to kiss me again first, please." He smiled, and we ended up mussing my dress up, so he had to smooth it down for me again. Fortunately, St. Joseph's Roman Catholic Church wasn't too far away. I loved that it was named after Joseph, the dreamer. I wondered if he'd had other dreams in his life besides the three recorded in the Gospel of Matthew. He had listened to his dreams, obeyed God's messengers. Vaguely, I remembered my grandmother had had a saint she sometimes prayed especially to. Her patron saint, I think she'd called her. I decided that if I ever chose a patron saint, it would have to be Joseph. Steve wasn't wearing a suit, but he still looked timelessly elegant in a long-sleeved white linen shirt that exposed a very sexy crescent of his tanned chest and shoulders, and which, worn over dark brown pants and leather sandals, made him look as much like a 21st-century disciple as possible. I told him so as we were walking up the steps of the impressive structure, and the way he smiled at me seemed to tell me he was aware of making a religious fashion statement, and that he was pleased I had noticed. He did not hold my hand as we entered the church, which was full of light and people. I was used to walking into dark, empty churches with Carol, who had a morbid obsession with them, especially if it was snowing outside, which apparently did something really haunting to the light. But there were no ghosts in St. Joseph's,
My eyes feasted on golden flagstones, sage-green walls, a dome the color of a light blue spring sky, white and yellow columns supporting half-moon arches on either side of the central aisle, and wooden pews with open backs polished to a golden hue. The sound of my heels clicking on the floor sounded incredibly loud to me, and I made an effort to walk more lightly. Toward the front and on the left side of the aisle, there was a large group of nuns in habits of a lovely blue color and long, soft white veils. I was relieved when, with a light touch on my arm, Steve directed me into a pew near the back of the church, preceding me so that I had an aisle seat. I was glad to have my little blue leather purse to cling to as I rested it on my lap, and every now and then looked around me. The narrow stained glass windows, set high in the walls, were a dark blue divided into dozens of small windows by black frames. Just behind and on either side of the white altar, the stained glass windows were open to let in more light and air. Restless as a bird unexpectedly flown into a strange new forest, possibly full of hidden magic, my vision darted here and there, but it mainly moved back and forth between Steve, who was kneeling with his eyes closed and his head bent over his crossed hands, and the nearly life-size figure of Christ crucified on the wall behind the altar, a golden sun emitting rays of light crowning his dark, lowered head. His straight, painted body looked much more comfortable than I felt. He was just an icon. There was no vestige of blood or pain. It was a Catholic hieroglyph, fraught with so much meaning. I felt it would take me a lifetime to decipher, and even then it would remain a mystery. The impossibility of God allowing himself to be killed for us, and rising again on the third day, so we might all be saved from death. Then lightning seemed to strike in my heart as I thought, so why didn't God just make us totally good and obedient to him in the first place?
Free will.
In reality, it was entirely my choice to open myself up to God or not. I felt then that I understood, in a less literal sense, what it meant to have been created in God's image. I was a free soul, gifted with the power to wonder and create, to imagine and to play, to hope and to dream. And at the heart of all these things was the power to receive love and give love, to live forever in love, with God or not. Crossing himself, Steve slipped back into the pew beside me. I wondered if he had been praying for me. I felt he had, and that his prayer had been answered. During Mass, I held on to my revelation, cupping it in the grasp of my understanding, like water, that inevitably began slipping between other much less sublime thoughts. At first, I worried the profound comprehension that had surged through me would soon drain away completely, but it didn't. Even when I let go of it, giving in to distractions, I discovered that when I turned my mind and heart back toward the experience, it was still there, and not a drop of the relief and joy it had filled me with had evaporated. I still knew the Our Father by heart. I had secretly said it every night before going to sleep after my grandparents died. And now, when I closed my eyes and joined my voice with so many others, I felt lifted out of myself into one human voice as together we sailed a dark ocean of belief and longing. Jesus had given us this prayer himself. Then the priest declared, "Peace be with you." We replied, "And also with you." And I was a kid again, smiling and shaking hands and waving to everyone around me, beginning with Steve. Not long after that, he left me to receive communion. At least I wasn't the only person who didn't line up to approach the altar. Before I could receive the body and blood of Christ, I had to go to reconciliation, which in my grandparents' time was called confession, and be confirmed.
"The sacraments," Steve had explained, "are not only a visible symbol of the reality of God, they are also supernatural means by which God enacts his grace."
Steve's rooftop was to die for, and, unbelievably, we had it all to ourselves. Directly in front of our comfortable wicker chairs, the sun was setting between the two tallest pyramids, the fading light reflected by the palatial expanse of polished rose-colored tiles at our feet. An apartment with a view